podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the Don Neely view system, Diogis. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
Hello and welcome to the 34th episode of the Pirate Rugby Podcast. We're just over 60 YouTube subscribers away from the big one ton, so a huge thank you to everyone for tuning in so far. If you could help us get to that magic 1,000 number, it changes everything, changes our lives. So if you could hit subscribe, and if you are a regular viewer and you're not subscribed, please hit the button now, and thank you. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter and subscribe to our Substack as well. Links for everything will be in the Linktree link down in the description box below. You can find the Substack in there, which you will get all of our content sent direct to your inbox. And you'll also get a long read article sent to you every Sunday called The Sunday Read, which will take our favorite topic of the week. And you can read all about it. This week, we did our top five things that we prefer about the women's Six Nations over the men's Six Nations. So if you're interested to read about those opinions, jump over there and maybe subscribe to the Substack as well. Anyway, that's enough of me promoting things. It's time to introduce this week's wonderful guest, earning his third cap for the Pirate Rugby, I do believe.
Third.
We'll say third. a man with more rugby output than Lavani Bottia after two Weetabix. It is my friend from the south of Ireland. It is Caelan Scully. Thank you for being here, mate.
Thanks for having me on again, Hugh. It's amazing. I only seem to get podcast invites after a defeat. I was also invited onto another one for tomorrow, not talking about Munster, but as a Munster fan, to be invited on here to talk Champions Cup it's tough, especially with the Sunday game moves your grieving process, and it's like, oh, I have to grieve the whole way through Sunday, and then it rolls into Monday, you know. The Monday blues really extend, but I think I'm fine. I think I'm fine. If I start crying, you know why, but yeah.
Okay. Well, there's lots of things to take your anger out on in the course of this pod, so people should stick around.
Saracens will be one of them. That'll be fun.
Oh, okay. Don't give too many spoilers away. So let's just do our international weather check here in the Midlands of England. It's been all the weather today. It was beautiful for a bit, and then it was absolutely hammering down with rain, and it's been windy all the time. I assume it's similar-ish in Ireland.
It's a lovely day. As we said, there's a grand old stretch in the evening. It was really bright up until about 20 minutes ago. Now, I have the lights on for lighting purposes for anyone here on YouTube. But no, it was lovely all day, and got the lawns cut and got the washing out. And everyone's happy on a day like that, especially in the month of April. Masters week. It should be springy and summery on Masters week.
Well, yeah, because I haven't paid for TNT. I haven't been able to sit on the sofa all day and watch all the rugby, so I did my lawn as well.
So you see, that wasn't an option for me. I was glued to it from 8 o'clock Friday night until 7:30. We recorded podcast at 7:30 on Sunday after the Connacht match, so basically any time between that was filled just watching rugby, and not a lot of great rugby.
Because I watched the Formula One, and that's on early in the morning at the moment. Once the Formula One's finished, I can switch over to Rugby Pass TV and watch Japan League One. So I've been watching a little bit of that. So my rugby actually starts at like 6:30 a.m. these days of the weekend.
That's super rugby level times, but maybe not super rugby level commitment. But maybe that's for another podcast.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, we're going to go on with our moments of the week now. The moment of the week this week is brought to you by the Captain Dr. Rachel Malcolm Fan Club mug. Produced and supplied by our friend Leslie. Shout out Leslie. Go on to her Twitter and you can find where to buy these. It has taken the internet by storm, I think it's fair to say. Yeah. Anyway, my rugby moment of the week was another person who's taken the internet by storm. And it was going to be Simon Wright-Lewis following me on Twitter, which I was very excited about.
That's a very big name drop for a couple of minutes into a podcast.
But it has to be friend of the show. Brilliant guest for us, AP Cronje, becoming a legend of Champions Cup rugby for the 1,000-yard stare over Manny Lubbock's shoulder in his Bulls top, just there in Cape Town. Absolutely iconic. Just the unblinking with the big glasses and the baseball cap just made everything.
I think it's, we all had that moment as well. We were like, yeah, I recognize that guy. And the fact that he had the picture up saying that he was at the match before it, and we're all like, yeah, we recognize this, and it's the Blues top, and we all know what's going to happen with Manny's kick as well, which just made it. I think the camera person, I think there was a French TV director, as we like to say. They knew Manny was missing. They found the Bulls jersey in the background.
The camera person must have known who he was, because why else would he do it? Because the way it panned over and the focus shifted, it was incredible. And like, put his girlfriend's there in the Stormers top behind him, can't see it. And like, it was just like, hang on a minute, that's AP. And then it was AP.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Iconic. There's the beaten only by the Damien Willems calling the scrum from the mark, in my opinion. Most iconic shot in South African rugby history.
Yeah.
What was your moment, mate?
I forgot I had to do a moment of the week. So when you started, I was thinking, oh God, what am I going to do? And I now have two. The first one is Bordeaux's disallowed try, where Louis Bielbiari sent Elliot Daly to the cleaners. I described it last night in a group chat. It was like the Sol Campbell slide tackle all over again. Daly was just going, like, he was on the ground and he had nowhere to go. Bielbiari was gone, but it was disallowed by Frank Murphy, the greatest hair in refereeing. But the actual moment of the week has to be La Rochelle are staying in Cork. And that is the best bit of shithousing that we have seen. I know Chasing the Sun, there's some great bits there, and New Zealand rugby and French rugby, everyone has their own bits of shithousing. But for Ron O'Gara to make a conscious decision 2 or 3 weeks ago and be like, right, if we beat the Stormers,
I'm going to take them to 5.
Adidas connection, yes. That's one we should get into. If we beat the Stormers, I'm going to take them to a 5-star resort in Cork, in my hometown. Because famously, actually, this was non-TNT. Ron O'Gara was on the RT broadcast before the match last year. And he was asked, what's it like? Is it a home final for you? He was like, no, this isn't Cork. This is Dublin. And there is, like, for any Irish listeners, they know, like, Cork people, they think it's the real capital of Ireland and everything. And for Rog to do that this week, it is the Declan Kidney vibe, who was the former Munster coach. It's the Alex Ferguson. It's, let's put all the attention on myself. No one's going to talk about how we kind of limped over the line and a couple of key players aren't playing that well, and Aldreed is kind of carrying us a small bit. No one's going to talk about that now. All they're going to ask about is Cork, how the players finding Cork. And it's all, that's all the talk that's going to be. And as I kind of said, if it even gets into Leinster minds for a split second, he's won. And that is the wonderful beauty of it. Now, I'm a Munster fan. Of course, I love Rog. And there's a lot of reasons not to like Rog, which we won't get into. But this was an unbelievable move. It was just so clever. I think Ilta Dafydd was the first one to report it this week. And ever since then, it has just been, it's all that anyone's talking about, isn't it?
I want to get him on the pod, by the way. He'd be a great interview.
Great guest. He's been on my own.
Was he?
With you? No, with Carly, actually. Very, very good.
Cool. Right. I'll definitely get him on. Sensational scenes. Listeners' moments of the week. Julia, who we had on the pod last week. Before, time is a blur and a construct. Anyway, Julia says, you're going to have to help me with the name here. So the Irish women's rugby player Maloney, who's come back.
Kleena.
What's that?
Kleena Maloney. So Kleena. Think of it, drop the DH. It's C-L-I-O-N-A and pronounce it that way. It's Kleena Maloney.
Okay. So I'm still learning about women's rugby. So why is this such a big deal?
Kleena Maloney, about 2 years ago, famously spoke out against Anthony Eddy, the former women's performance director in IRFU, and she's basically said something about how he was spreading slurry about the women's game or something to that effect. I don't have the exact quote in front of me. And Greg McWilliams, who was the former head coach at the time, even though she was ripping up trees in the Premiership, which is by far the best women's club competition in the world, despite the fact that she was doing really well over there, she wasn't selected, and everyone kind of knew why. It was, you know, it had to come from above, or maybe he didn't want it. I've heard some people say that maybe the coaching staff didn't want a presence like hers to kind of command the room, which is a fair theory. I've heard that from people close by. So for her to get recalled after 2 years in exile, despite playing really, really good rugby in the Premiership, is fantastic. And it feels like a sliding doors moment. And just on that, David Nusifora, who many people may know is the performance director of the RFU, he's leaving. David Humphreys is coming in to replace him, former Ireland out half, was involved with England cricket. I think you may be familiar with his work there. So he's the one who's coming in. And it just felt like, it felt like a bit of a watershed moment that Scott Beaman, maybe now he's finally getting to pick the players he wants. And like, he's an English coach. There's no way he doesn't know how good Liam Maloney is. The only thing is, like, if there's ever a position where we could do with, you know, depth, it's not actually at hooker, because Neve Jones is absolutely fantastic, but we'll take it. Yeah. Because feck it, if we can get them as a 50-30 or a 60-20, you wouldn't say no. I'm not sure if she'd be involved at the weekend, but still great to see. And it's great to see that someone hasn't been completely drowned out for what they said in the past, and what they said was right as well, which is the other side of it. Like, it's not like she spoke out because of some non-story. Like, the treatment of the women's game in Ireland, I think you touched on it yourselves, has been nothing short of a shambles. So good to see her back in.
Well, you wouldn't want her big moment to be spoiled by your humiliating defeat at the hands of Wales this weekend anyway. So
Well, I wouldn't be the most positive ahead of that game, but that's more because the Welsh team are sensational.
Oh, don't undermine me by being nice. Anyway, I'm going to move on now to Maz's, our friend Maz's moment of the week. That's Maz's moment of the week is her local team, RACA, which their proper name probably has none of those letters in it. Securing back-to-back promotions and winning Regional D. So that's a fantastic moment for them. Congratulations. Right, let's get straight into the meaty business of the week, and that is the announcements. Well, not announcements, the news that is broken was first broken by, I think it was Kelleher of the Times.
I think it was Will Kelleher, yeah. I think we'd heard about this ages ago through Rugby Pass or the Times as well. And now it's kind of starting to properly come into fruition.
Yeah. So I'm reading from a Guardian article. And it says thus, Rugby Union's first Club World Cup is set to be staged in June 2028 after the major men's leagues in both hemispheres agreed key principles on the project, the Guardian can reveal. The plans also mean the Champions Cup will have no winners that year, as the global tournament will replace its knockout stages. Eight teams will qualify from the Champions Cup for the new global event. Six teams will qualify from Super Rugby and two more, probably from Japan's Rugby League One, most likely competing in a knockout format across 4 week ends in June. So there's lots more written in all of the articles that you can read about it. They go on and on. I guess, Kaelin, what's your immediate reaction to this news?
I think what stands out is the idea that we're going to have a Champions Cup that is essentially a preliminary qualifier where there's no winner, even though the Champions Cup has run every year since 1995, yeah. And yeah, there's been a winner. And now we're going to scrap that when, in my opinion, to do a Club World Cup, I would much rather if you just did like Japan League winner versus MLR and Super Rugby winner versus European winner, just as a once off. And
well, we had that. That's why Munster are world champions, right?
Well, look, we won't get into that now because it's been a rough week, Hugh. But yes, we are the unofficial world champions of the world forever. But it is a bit of a... I'm just not a fan of this. I'm not... Like, I know it's not technically extra games, but you're bringing in something new that most fans won't be able to attend, that is likely to be held in potentially a Gulf state, which some people reckon it will be, which there's obvious reservations there, that fans probably won't be attending, and scrapping a competition which has already ruined its own identity and struggling to find a new identity since its rebranding, which honestly, like I've touched on that. We did a podcast ages ago about the Champions Cup and its guys. I think this just kills it. And Super Rugby as well. Like they're having ideological issues as well. Like, they're sitting there, they don't know if they're Super Rugby, Super Rugby Pacific, Oceania, you know, what was it? Was there Locked or something? Unlocked was 1 year, Aotearoa. Like, they've had so many name changes, so many sponsor changes. I just think this is another one that fans probably won't get behind. And you're going to be asking a couple of club teams to travel over the end of the season, half of them won't want to do it. You can be guaranteed at least some of the clubs won't want to be there, be it, you know, a Bulls or, you know, a Leinster. Like, if you're the IRFU and if Leinster wants to qualify, for instance, do you send basically half the Irish team on essentially a joyride to the other side of the world to play a game that you're not going to make any revenue out of, that could damage your chances in a summer tour, or could just make your season longer, even though it doesn't. But when you add in flights and everything, it kind of does in its own way. I think, obviously, it's different for, say, from an Irish perspective because we're union-led. But I just don't see there being a huge buy-in. I can see certain clubs buying into it. You know, the same clubs who love to do these things. I could see Munster potentially buying into it because they love, like, if it's in Dubai, Munster have essentially a dinner in Dubai every year. So I could see them trying to do it, for instance. But not every club will. And unless there is that complete buy-in, like, what's the point? If you're to lose, are you really going to be like, do you know what? I do not want to win the coveted top 14 title. I want to win this thing where we could be eliminated after one day and have to be sent home.
Well, the just French take the summer off anyway. So after their top 14 final, I can't see. And it does say in the Guardian article as well, as ever, I'm quoting here, as ever, it is the French who will make or break the new competition. They are understood to have come round to the idea in a meeting in November, and they have agreed in principle to the plan. Their beloved season finale, which is a French word that I'm not going to try and say, will be played this year on the 28th of June. So it would represent a significant rejig for the French to take part in this. Now, the qualification thing. Well, firstly, before I say that, the issue for me is, initially, if this is happening in 2028, we don't know what club rugby is going to look like in 2028. Super Rugby could look like anything. The URC could look like anything. Probably the top 14 is the one that will be most similar to how it currently is in 2028. Goodness knows what's going to be going on with the Premiership by the time we get to then. So, you know, to make decisions this big based off that, it is kind of unfair. And I, in terms of the qualification, firstly, I do not see the European Cup and Super Rugby as being equitable. So it's, for me, the Southern Hemisphere doesn't have a equivalent of the European Cup. Super Rugby is an equivalent to the URC, in my opinion.
I think we were discussing it. We were discussing it before we came on, but like the most recent URC champion and the most recent Premiership champion would not be qualified if you took this year's format. Is that really what a Club World Cup should be? I understand the Bundesliga champion doesn't really make it in England or in the FIFA Club World Cup, but that's different. That's literally, you know, in the middle of the season, and it's this kind of, it's an extra, essentially. It's not like you're not cutting off the Champions League to go play it. If you're going to do that, like, I'd nearly just have the three league champions, to be honest. Run off the end of your URC top 14 in Premiership, send them, and send potentially one more if you wanted to do, for instance, you know, guaranteed a South African team at least, or, you know, depending on how the URC is done, maybe two URC teams. Those four go and they play off and go from there. Like, that might be better. I understand, obviously, you've to add in Super Rugby as well. But even like four Australian teams, for instance, or three Australian teams, but not the most recent URC or Premiership champion, that just doesn't feel right. Do you know what I mean? It just feels thrown together for the sake of it and not fully thought out, which I think a lot of things that we come back on in breaking news in rugby is that's what we land on. It's not fully thought out. I feel like a lot of guys on Twitter sort these things quicker than World Rugby actually do.
Three Australian teams and potentially two Japanese teams. Now, I'm not hating on the Japanese league. I'm really getting into it. But like three Australian teams, but one South African team. If it was to go on this year's knockout stages, it would be three Premiership teams, three French teams, three Australian teams, three Kiwi teams, if we were taking the cut right now, one Irish team, one South African team. That doesn't pass the laugh out loud test for me. And by the way, like you said, like Stormers and Munster wouldn't be in it. That doesn't feel right to me. Stade Francais, currently top of the top 14, wouldn't be in it.
Saracens, the reigning champions. I hate standing up for Saracens, but like they wouldn't be in it either. Sale, who were the finalists in the Premiership, they wouldn't be in it.
I'm going to come out and say it. You know, sorry to my friend Jake, who's a big Exeter fan. Exeter being in it, but Stormers not, is a farce. And of course, you know, that's not how it is at the moment because it's not happening this year, but it's a potential scenario. And it comes back to the qualification. For getting into the Champions Cup, you have to remember that still we live in a world where the Premiership gets 8 teams into the Champions Cup out of 10, which means the Sale team that just failed to fire a shot down in Bridgend against Ospreys are pretty much guaranteed a spot in the Champions Cup next year. Like that's the world that we live in. So if it's a World Cup, having potentially no teams from Scotland, no teams from Wales, no teams from Italy, obviously no like tier two nations, like no Georgian team, no American team from MLR. It's just not what it's a classic case of rugby old boys club. It's like, hang on, we need to help each other out here, you know,
There's an elephant in the room as well that we've kind of, I'm not saying we've jumped over it on purpose, but like, who's going to bring the most eyeballs onto this competition? Australia is a huge country. Like it's massive, but they're not going to bring the eyes. New Zealand love their rugby, but they have made it pretty abundantly clear they don't like getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to watch matches, which is fair enough. I don't either. Essentially, the money is to be made off of Ireland, France, South Africa. And as you said, there'd be more French teams than Ireland and South Africa combined. And again, like I know that's not what it boils down to, but ultimately the only reason they're doing this competition is for money. And you're kind of just going one direction. As you said, the old boys club kind of philosophy. Oh, well, Australia, they're big into their rugby, but like, are Australians really going to care about a game against like Quins, you know, or Exeter? Mm. Like half of them probably don't know where Exeter is. And I don't mean that to be rude. Like, of course, some of them do. But like, do they care? Do we care? Like, you know, it's different. It just feels not thought out. Like,
how can I watch a Club World Cup and take it seriously if it's like, I don't know. I think on current standings, the Melbourne Rebels would get in. Like,
and they're about Melbourne Rebels.
Melbourne Rebels against Exeter, and they're like Club World Cup, biggest showcase in club rugby. Like, and Munster and Stormers are sat at home, and Stade Francais are sat at home, and whoever else it is, Bath. Yeah. Anyway, so it's just, and again, as I was saying to you before the show, because of the way the qualification works, is there would be 8 URC teams who would be out of it, like 18 months in advance. So you got this big thing coming up next summer, but because you're not in the top 8 in the URC, you know you're not in it. So, and like we said, that could be some pretty big clubs, if not entire nations, just don't care about it because their team isn't in it. And also, why is it every 4 years? Like, how does that work as an idea? And are we about to see that we're building for a World Cup come to the club game?
Yeah, and like, even at that, like, listen, I know we've got a lot of South African fans, and I love what South Africans have brought to the URC, but not every country hinges everything on the World Cup. Like, New Zealand, South Africa do. Ireland, France, England, it's a bonus in some regard. Obviously, they'd love to win it, don't get me wrong. But, like, if you're going doing that in the club game...
South African listeners are thinking you would have a different story if you'd won it, which is probably true, but we haven't won it, so we're sticking to
it. It's probably true, but we haven't. And, like, the other side of it is, like, if they were being told to cut short the Currie Cup, for instance, they wouldn't like it, which understandably, it's a prestigious competition. The top 14 wouldn't be cut short, but are you really telling me that Toulouse are going to send all their frontliners on this trip to, let's just say, Dubai or let's just say Japan for a game that they're probably going to win with some rotation anyways? Are you really going to send Dupont? Are you really going to send like Entmac or Challenge or Flamont? And I understand I'm just listing how good their squad is at the moment, but like, are you going to do it, or are you just going to be like, right, we don't care about Europe this season, we'll win our home games, and we probably won't send the squad anyway, so it doesn't make a difference. We're literally just going to focus on top 14 all season. And then that means when you hit December, 9 months out, or 6 months or 7 months out from the Club World Cup, a lot of teams have already made up their mind about what they're going to do and what they're going to target. They're just going to target their two home games in Europe. They won't give a shite about their two away games. They're just going to, you know, two home games, grand. And then Europe just becomes, like, it becomes the worst part of the top 14. It, you know, when the top 14 has those weeks where it's just all home wins and it gets predictable, or essentially what the Champions Cup was this week, bar La Rochelle. And it's like, ugh. That's just most people's feelings. Like, ugh, I don't really want this.
Trying to make club rugby into an event is trying to put a circle into a square for me. Like, international rugby is the event. International rugby is the special one-off. Club rugby is the process. Club rugby is the week.
You tweeted it, like, and a lot of people, what was the, people said more club games, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I did a poll on Twitter asking how would you change the rugby calendar? Would you have more club games and fewer test matches, or fewer club games and more test matches? And it was something like 62-38
or something, yeah.
Percent said more club matches, fewer test matches, which is probably what, you know, my following is mostly hardcore rugby fans. So that's probably what they would say. That's what I would say as well. I would rather have more club games than fewer test matches.
I wouldn't, to be honest. I understand it's like everyone sees it differently depending on their national team and their club team and whatever. But at the end of the day, what funds the game? It's the international game. If I'm going to see more matches, I want less matches as it is. I find the rugby season to be very drawn on at times. Like, I think the URC, if the URC is going to expand, they cannot go above 18 games. Because 18 games is like, grand. This is fine. Like, top 14, fair enough. They have their model that has worked 4 years, and I understand that. But for everyone else, I don't think it works. I don't think it would work in Super Rugby to go longer with more clubs. Don't think it would work in the URC. The Premiership, fair enough. They're cut down. I'm just the opposite. I think more internationals, get the money in. I don't like the idea of what's it called in soccer? Nations League kind of idea. I don't like those ideas. I'm okay with having test matches and having tours. But my big bugbear is have those tours and send South Africa to go to America and send Ireland to go to the Pacific Islands. But that just doesn't happen. That's a dream world where world rugby actually care about the greater game outside of, again, the old boys club.
Yeah. Anyway, so I think that's enough ranting about that for now.
I think that's enough ranting about that. Can we just leave the Munster game to last when we go on to Champions Cup? Because
okay. Yeah. Okay. So just quickly before, while we're just on the subject of test match rugby, and the big news this week was that TNT have secured the rights. And obviously we like to track TV rights on the show. Ender isn't here this week, but this would be his big thing. So TNT are the look to be positioning themselves as the rugby broadcaster in the UK and Ireland. And they have secured the rights for all autumn international games in the UK and Ireland from this autumn?
This year.
Yeah. So, what's your take on this? Let's say it's split opinion.
I'll take off the I don't like be sorry TNT's coverage out for a minute. The first mistake was taking it off BBC and ITV 4 or 5 years ago, or 3 years ago, whenever it was. I don't know. COVID messed up.
England games have been on Sky for ages.
But Sky came in the 90s, and one of their things was they took all England games, and then they fed some of them back. Like, that was, we got through that rough period. And I know people talk about, sometimes people are just going to push back about whatever change there is. But ultimately, for me, national games, keep them on your national broadcaster. And if TNT want to pick up the rights for, say, I know it's different in the UK, but if TNT want to be the rights holders in Ireland for all other games, fair enough. We don't work in that kind of, you know, we don't have the same level of geo-blocking as they do in America, where it's literally a line in the road where you could be blocked out. But I feel like you're making the international game into, again, more of a product is the wrong word, because obviously sport is a product, it's an entertainment product, but like, I don't know. I'm just not a big fan of it. I think it's harder. And I can get TNT. Like, I can literally switch over. I have a PlayStation controller here. I can switch over to TNT right now if I want to. It's not about that. I'm just not a big fan of it as a move. I liked when it was on BBC. I liked how the home nations, to use that word. I don't know if that's a word you use at all. It's what's used here. I don't know if that's the way forward, but it's certainly better than a broadcaster that's like 30 quid a month, when even Amazon was only like 8 or 9 quid a month. And if you were a student, it was even less. And if you already had Amazon Prime, it was less.
Yeah,
and
yeah, like everybody has Amazon.
Well, I don't, to be honest.
A lot of people already have Amazon.
I've about 4 email addresses, and the plan was, haven't used this email for Amazon yet. I'll get the month's free trial there, but that's gone. Thank you, TNT.
Yeah, for me, it's a cost thing. For me, absolutely, the money that they charge for it is not reflected in the quality of the product for me. And, you know, I've already got Sky. So to pay for TNT, you know, realistically, I'm going to have to cancel Sky for a month to get this. It's just a pain. You know, we've talked about what we do like and don't like about broadcasters in the past. Yeah, it's just you worry. Like, for example, the next game that we're going to talk about, first game in Europe, Stormers versus La Rochelle, didn't have any pre-match build-up or halftime punditry on TNT. Yeah, this weekend.
Above all else, that's inexcusable. Because at the end of the day, SuperSport were down there pitch side. Just do a simulcast. You're both broadcasters. They're the host broadcaster of that game. Just do a simulcast. But I think it's, maybe this is an incredibly arrogant thing for an Irish person to say. I feel like there's a bit of an English kind of arrogance about TNT's broadcasts.
Yeah.
And like, they would never do a simulcast with anyone. Like, at least, like, you watch NFL on Sky at stupid o'clock and they're like, we're not going to have like ads every 10 minutes. We're just going to show like ESPN's coverage. And it just works out a bit better. And like, for a game like this, just do that. It just will run smoother. And even if this means that we don't get like people in a box room commentating on a game in South Africa, it's like, I'd actually nearly prefer it, to be honest. You know, now, granted, TG Carr, who a lot of people listening will not know of, they're an Irish language broadcaster whose budget is even tiny. Way tinier than S4C, for instance, or BBC Alba or any of them. Their budget is tiny. They flew down to Cape Town for the URC final last year. No one really knows how. They could have hiked. They could have walked with your man that just walked through Africa. I don't know. But just make it work. I hate these off-air broadcasts, because unless you were like the pinnacle commentator, some people make it work. Ryan Lugent did the Connacht game off-beat, and he kind of made it work because he's experienced. But a lot of the time, it just feels like ourselves sitting here in front of the telly talking about a match. And I'm like, no. But that's too much ranting. That's a separate rant. But anyways, TNT, yeah, it's the price.
Yeah, definitely the price for me. Anyway, let's talk about some actual rugby that actually happened and talk about the biggest game of the weekend by far, in my opinion, was Stormers versus La Rochelle in Cape Town. A thriller, a dramatic game, an incredible game to watch. Yes, it's kind of a shame that it happened in a round of 16, because if that was a semi-final, that's one that goes down as one of the all-time great games. What did you think watching it? How did the narrative flow for you?
The narrative for me was, there was only one game I was going to watch, and that 3 o'clock game slot on Saturday, and it was Stormers against La Rochelle. So straight away, that was the one to watch. I didn't see much of the first game when they met in Cape Town in round two. But I caught all of this, and it wasn't a great game. It was an unbelievable finish, but it wasn't a spectacular game of rugby. But La Rochelle, like all champion teams, they find a way to get the job done. And you have to admire someone like Gregory Audrey, consistently, when they are not playing that well, when they need a moment, when they just need someone to make 4 tackles in a 5-phase set, it's him. Someone to just kind of stand up and do something. And I think that's the difference between where the Stormers are right now and where La Rochelle are, as solidified top 2, top 3 teams in Europe, is your big game players, but they have a few of them, not just Audrey, it's Botia as well. I'm not fully convinced on all the Larochelle team. We might get onto that in a minute, but Botia, Aldreet, you know, those guys just, they just stand up every time and they're just there and fair play. And I think someone mentioned it. I think it was Potwells and Penguins with Barry Murphy and Andrew Trimble. They're like, you know, Rog and John Dobson were kind of having a bit of a, you know, back and forth slagging. They weren't beside each other, you know, in pre-match press conferences, but they're just kind of slagging each other about, oh, this team, we want this. And oh, of course he's saying that. And, you know, all the usual stuff. But I think ultimately, John Dobson is going to be kicking himself this week. He had a chance to take down a European giant at home. And they played really, really well in large passages. Did they play well enough to win the game, though? I don't think they did. And I think you can't really have any complaints in that regard. I think just better team won, and a team with experience of getting over the line consistently won, and a team who always loses to Adidas teams lost.
Yeah, I think the Stormers all this season really have been relying on having two or three moments of class to bail them out, and they would play, you'd be honest, play poorly for 70 minutes of a game, but not go like crazy behind, not concede very
the Ulster
much.
Game a week before is the prime example. They were not great in that game. They just needed a couple of moments, be it power, be it flair. You know, I think Willems had a couple of big carries in that game that took them a huge amount upfield, and then on the flip side, you know, really should have scored a try the last day. But that's the thing. They are relying on these moments, and that's fair enough. But it's almost too much. You know, it's not like, right, okay, chips are down, we're just going to play percentages. That's not what they do. They don't have three playmakers in their back line because they're just going to hoof it up into the air. Like, they could. Like, Willems and Gallant could chase kicks all day, but like, that's not what they do. And I admire it, but I don't know. European rugby is a big man's game, and Stormers are probably, not by a lot, but they're probably the lightest South African pack. They're the most athletic South African team by eye test, at least. And I think it showed a small bit. I think if that game is even the Bulls in Cape Town, I think the Bulls might get the job done, to be honest. You know, like, I understand the Stormers, they had their injuries. I know Diamani took a horrible blow, and wish him well with that. And they're different injuries across the back row, like Gian Ferry, possible season ender, but like, benches win European games. You know, if you can go 6-2 in a European game, like, it makes a huge difference. We've seen it with Northampton, we've seen it with La Rochelle, seen it with La Rochelle so many times. You know, it can win you games. And even like Leinster, who are the, you know, the pundits claim Leinster to be the self-appointed beacons of truth in European rugby. They've gone 6-2 this season. They recognise it. Yeah. Everyone recognises it.
Worked amazingly for them.
It has. Yeah, absolutely. And like, even I was critical of Ireland's use of the 6-2 bench. I don't think it worked in the Six Nations for what you want for a 6-2 to be. But it did kind of work for La Rochelle, even if it was just by just being better than the bare minimum, because the Stormers kind of ran out of subs and ran out of impact. It still worked. Like, when you bring on Paul Boudon off the bench as your replacement back row, like, that's not bringing on a light back row forward. That is a heavy combo back row blindside flanker, and it made a difference. I know it came down to a last minute kick, don't get me wrong, but like, even at that, La Rochelle should have been home and host at that stage. That game, in that kind of middle third, or not middle third, kind of the middle third of the second half, was all La Rochelle, and it felt like they were going to push on. And even, I think this is where they're going to get caught this week, I think that could have been just the journey in their legs. I think that was the only thing that really slowed them down. It slowed them down at the start of the game, and at the very end of the game, I think it'll slow them down this week, but I don't know. We might get into that later.
Yeah. I want to players that I want to call out as having incredible games. Obviously, Aldreet, I think, was by far the best player for La Rochelle.
He got that match, didn't he?
Probably. He really carried them at times. I thought, you know, everyone's trying to blame it on Lebok for the missed kick at the end, and like, oh, hopping on the narrative of Lebok can't kick a goal. Lebok was absolutely incredible in this game. His passing, his decision making, his distribution, he completely ran the team.
He was 4 from 4 as well before that kick, which isn't very Lebok-like either.
Yeah. It And then Damien Willems, they were just the moments of absolute class. But again, that's what we were saying. The Stormers just rely on moments so much. And eventually, you know, and maybe when you get three big injuries in a game, that's the kind of thing that just means.
And in the same position.
But at the same time, the margins are so close that Stormers will have loads of what ifs from that game. Every player will be thinking, oh, I've had to just damn this. You know, grounded the ball a bit closer to the sticks, or you know, Willems are passing on the inside to the vet or something. Anyway, so that's that one. So the other, I think, most spoken about result of the weekend was Saracens racking up a century for their trips to Bordeaux this season.
Yeah.
So that's 100 points taken in two games, 75 defenders beaten in two games, 15 line breaks, I want to say something like that.
And they weren't even no Jalibert this week. You know, like, yeah. Matthew Jalibert was not there. And to be fair, Garcia, I think he may have got man of the match as well. He was unbelievable. But yeah. Like, wow. And I think the thing is, how often do you see a team like Saracens concede 45 points and you're saying they're lucky it was only 45?
Because they're lucky to get two tries.
They were lucky to get two tries, absolutely. But like, the Bielbiari. Okay, I know he didn't score the try. The one they gave, I think he gave it to Deportier in the end, where he skims Daly that we mentioned earlier. That was marginally forward. And there was another try I disallowed. And I know there was the Deportier one where he literally bats the ball volleyball style, which was never going to be a try. But I don't know. I just thought it was just ruthless. And the crowd really got into it in that second half. And like that try that they scored in the corner off the tap and go was unreal. I thought Penno, I think you mentioned it on my own podcast. When Danny Pino isn't scoring tries, we think he's not playing well. But he had some runs in that game where he was like the greased up deaf guy from Family Guy. He was so hard to put down. And like, the thing is, he's deceptively powerful. Like, he can burst through a tackle, and he was doing that. He was causing havoc. I thought Saracens, like, they won titles based on power and their defense. They scored nice tries, but like, they had an unbelievable defense. It's amazing to see a team like Bordeaux cut them open, because Saracens are not going to get a beaten like that probably for the rest of the season. They've got a bad one off Northampton, but they're really not going to get that a lot this year.
So I've looked up the stats. So 100 points scored, 75 defenders beaten, 29 clean breaks, 15 tries. And like you say, there was a fair few disallowed in that as well.
I think it was three disallowed in the first like 20 minutes before the first try was given.
Wolves had three tries disallowed against Saracens as well in the pool stage.
Conspiracy? So, I think so.
So are Bordeaux, are they making it a big three with them, Toulouse and La Rochelle?
Big three in France, or are you purposely leaving out a certain team?
big three French teams.
Yeah, in Europe, yeah. But I think the thing is, for Bordeaux to be a European team that we look at next year, they have to back it up in the pool stages. Like, it can't just be some years they try. Because remember, they got to a semi-final a couple of years ago under their previous head coach and didn't win that. And they haven't been back in the knockouts since until now when they did what they did. And I think that they are getting there, but I think the reason is they have all the tools for European rugby. European rugby is pretty French, and this is going to sound so stupid, but like, what's the URC one on? It's really one in the midfield. Like, 6 to 12 is what wins you URC games. Find me a top URC team that doesn't have a good 10, a good 12, a good 8. Do you know what I mean? Like, they all do. It's very French in the fact that if you've got a big type 5 forwards and you've got back outside backs who can score tries from anywhere, you will kill it in Europe. And Bordeaux are one of those. I said it. I don't think I said it here. I think I said it on my own podcast. I don't know. It could have been here. Bordeaux have the best backline in club rugby. Like, by far. It is. Do you not agree?
No, I've got to. I still think Toulouse have got to take that title. You go man for man. Luco against DuPont and Tamak against Shelley.
But DuPont is a cheat code. Like, that's...
Well, yeah, but he's there. He exists. I think, is it Aki in the centres, or am I getting confused with Toulon?
But it is Peter Aki, but like Mo Fana in a Bordeaux shirt is a way different player than what he is in a French shirt. Like Deportaire, then like Deportaire is phenomenal. Biel Biarri, Mathis Lavelle is an unbelievable player. Biel Biarri is ahead of him. Like, I don't know. I think I'd go Bordeaux's backline. Yeah, I mean, Ramos gets in. I'm not saying it's a huge amount, but I just think Toulouse can get janky. And we discussed this during the week, messaging. Toulouse can get very janky when Dupont either isn't at nine or isn't in the team. And I think that's what's going to be their undoing. I think Bordeaux, if I was betting on it now, I'd probably have Bordeaux to get to the final, because I think Dupont coming in and out of training over the next couple of weeks, Entomac finding his feet again, they'll be chopping and changing nines and tens. I think that will come back to haunt them. Whereas Bordeaux, as we said, had a different 10 in and it looked no different. And some of that is because Luku stepped up and had a really, really good game.
Unbelievable. Best passing game in the world.
Best passing game. Best lines of running. Some of the best support lines. I know we say this about Leicester.
Passing anyway, before any rugby hardcore messages and go, actually, this passing that some team that you've never heard of do, that's statistically the best. Yeah, best to watch.
Like, I think they're second to Leinster in terms of support lines. I think they're, you know, how they get over the gain line, they win collisions. Like, it's important to remember, this wasn't just get the ball to Biel Biarri and Penno and they'll score. This was a lot of deception in midfield. This was a lot of power up the middle. You know, Tammy Funa had one fantastic carry at one stage in the first half where he's compressing defenses. I think this is the big thing about them. Guys like Penno, Mo Fana, Deportaire, Tammy Funa, the number eight whose name escapes me. I can't think. But guys like this, they're compressing defenders and they make it so hard, because then when they get that quick ball, Luku is a very smart player. He's very smart on front football. By the time Luku picks that ball off the base of the ruck, the defense is already incredibly compressed, going backwards, and you'll have someone like Penno running that arc or run out the back door. Like, there is times where you just think, how do you stop this? Do you know? And like every team that's left in the competition, I think it's fair to say, have a really good attack. I don't think attack wins games too often because everyone has a fairly decent standard, but like Bordeaux are just fun. Maybe that's what's getting ahead of me. I just think they're a lot of fun. And I love this. I've been doing this for years, but Bordeaux are fun.
Yeah, they are a lot of fun. Because I watch the top 14, I see all these teams in the top 14, and teams like La Rochelle and Bordeaux are different in the top 14. They have moments like this, for sure, but I've seen them all lose games in quite tough fashions as well. So it's kind of different kettle of fish, I suppose.
Are we taking... So we can't take any game for granted, but you kind of can. If Bordeaux and Toulouse are going to be the two in a semi-final, that could really come down to, do Bordeaux switch off, which they did the last time they met, and they still got off the line.
Bordeaux love to switch
and if
off.
Toulouse do get janky, as I said, where they just have those moments where it's either no Dupont, or they put Dupont at 10, or Ramos doesn't have a great day at 10, or Entomac doesn't look up to shape. That one's really hard to call, isn't it? And especially like home country advantage, like Bordeaux and Toulouse are not that far away from each other. There's going to be a huge crowd from both. You know, it's going to be a lot of fun if they play each other. But that's the one thing about Bordeaux, I think, is the big question mark. I think you mentioned it a few times. If they switch off, they could be caught. I don't see it happening this weekend, but against Toulouse, as we've seen in the last league game, it nearly cost them the game again, where they just kind of gone to sleep for about 5 minutes, and no better team than Toulouse with Antoine Dupont running parallel to the try line and then just being like, oh, you score. Done. Yeah. You know.
Oh, well. That's why we watch the games. That's what makes it exciting. Just to flip the narrative, the fall of Saracens has been sudden and dramatic. Obviously, English reigning champions. They're currently third or fourth in the Premiership, I believe.
Yeah, I think so.
But it's one of those where they've won eight games. I think there's about six teams in the English Prem that's won eight games and lost six. So it's they're just part of the pack in England now. Humiliating results, you'd have to say, for a team of that stature, a club of that stature. And the game in Pretoria should have been a lot heavier on the scoreline as well.
And last weekend against Northampton, they scored two tries in the last like 90 seconds.
What do you put it down to? What's gone wrong?
Oh God, it's the $1 million question. I think if I solve this, I'd be banned from ever reading the Times in England. But I think some of it is players departing. I'm not putting the blame on Owen Farrell like the English media would. But I think when you've got a lot of ins and outs coming in and you know there's a bit of a rebuild. Like I heard months ago that Mark McGall was being lined up potentially to get the Ulster job. It mightn't have been true. But I think when it's at that level that he's being looked at and we knew there was a rebuild coming with at least one marquee player leaving, I think it has just been a season of it had like Exeter last year felt like, right, this is our last dance. Saracens this year have kind of fallen between two stools. I think that's been a huge factor in it. And yeah, they've regressed. Not being able to overspend on your squad does take a toll. Absolutely. You know, their 23 is not as scary.
As Lawrence Tavaglia was quick to point out, that how can they expect it to be competing anymore when they're not financially doping?
Imagine. But then to be fair, like, you know, Munster fan here, we have a lot of money. We also don't have half the amount of money the Leinster do. But anyways, getting back to that, with Saracens, I think there is that period of change. And I think if they went 100% all out, right, this is the season. We're just going to leave everything else to the side, like Exeter did last year. We're going to go gung-ho. No one's going to stop us. Great. But just that mentality just doesn't seem to be the same as what it used to be. And they talk about Wolfpack, and I think it's really, really cringy. But I just don't think there's as in it as they were. And like, you see Mauro Itoje being a better player for England than he is for Saracens at the moment. And like, that kind of says a lot, because that was never the case. As good as he was for England back in the day, he was unstoppable for Saracens. You're carrying guys like Billy Vunipola at number 8. Like, quite frankly, Billy Vunipola does not start for half of the top 14 teams.
Who could be in the Pro Day Deux next season.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like, but Montpellier is a home for old, aging players who once had it. But
stay tuned for a video on Montpellier. I've been promising for a long time, but wow. I spoke to Ben Nurse about this. I messaged him and said, hey, what's your take on what's going on with Sarries at the moment? And he said something along your lines, as he did say it was a mentality thing. And he said, they've just got a squad full of players who've got nothing left to prove. So they had all the glory years winning Prem titles, European titles. Then they got the relegation and then they came back and then they got back to the Prem final first year back from being relegated. Then they won the Prem second year back from being relegated. They've all been on started Lions tests. They've all, won Six Nations. Just they don't have the hunger anymore. And it's quite a stale squad as well, you'd have to say.
It's very stale. That's what I was going to get onto after that, because it's one thing having these older players, but there doesn't seem to be a transition. Do you know what I mean? It's not like, and listen, I understand a club like Saracens, it's not necessarily about having, 35 academy guys from the local area. It's not about that. But when they were at their pomp, they were bringing through a couple of guys, like, for instance, Mauro Itoje being the very obvious one. But they had a lot of young players. Like, you think back to 2014 and you think compare that to 2019, you think about all the change. Whereas now it feels like any changes they've made since, say, 2019, which was their last hurrah, has been changes backwards. I think that's ultimately what it is. And no matter how good Jamie George, Mauro Itoje, Owen Farrell, no matter how good these guys play, ultimately they've taken a step back in terms of the quality of the squad. And as you said, some guys don't have it left to prove, but like, ultimately, if you want to be a top team in Europe, someone like Marito or someone like Billy Vunipola should be struggling to get into the team at this stage. Even like Theo Dan has fairly broken down the door of Jamie George, and that's fair enough. I think that's a sign where they have. But like Mako, Billy Vunipola, Eddie Daly to a lesser degree. It's a couple of positions there where you're like, right,
I can't believe that Alex Good is still going.
Yeah, well, he kind of defies logic in some regard. I just thought he had a good first half the last day, but Yeah, no, it is. It's another example, isn't it? Like
Maitland. Maitland's still starting every week.
Yeah. Like, does Maitland start for Manny? Does Sean Maitland, does Billy Vodopola, and does Alex Goode start for any other team in the last eight in Europe this week? Realistically, they might.
Sean Maitland is a Scottish player playing for Saracens, not getting picked for Scotland.
Yeah. Granted, that's Scotland have wingers, but you know.
Well, they had an injury crisis in the back three at the beginning of the Six Nations. Anyway,
that's true.
So let's shift to another English team now. I'm easing you into it. Are Northampton good? Do we all have to just take it and admit Northampton Saints are a good rugby team?
Northampton are a good team. One of the things that, well, when you asked me to come on, and I was thinking about it, not thinking about whether I come on, it's obviously a guess you, but I was thinking about like Northampton and discussing them because I've thought a lot about Munster this week, as I would, and I think Northampton are a very good team. I think they're a very extremely well-coached team. No team progresses that much in a year. They were fairly average last year. No team progresses that much in a year without very good coaching, and that's a credit to Phil Dowson and to his staff. My only concern with them is there is an element of, if not now, when? Courtney Laws is leaving. Lewis Ludlam's leaving. Alex Waller. A couple of other guys. Like, they're going to have to reshape how they play rugby when they lose Ludlam and Laws, because they've got a third lock at six, or a lock hybrid, whatever you want to call them, and a power open side. Are they going to sign that? Like, what I'd love to see, as long as it doesn't come back to bite Munster in the ass again, I'd love to see them sign someone like Jack Willis. Granted, he's not the biggest open side in rugby, but he's punchy. He's punchy as hell. And guys like that, like, that's what they did really well. And I think, you know, Finn Smith and Alex Mitch is a really good pairing. I thought Berger Odendahl, again, punchy, maybe not the best all-round 12 in Europe or in the Premiership, but very good. Tommy Freeman had a good game of the wing. James Ram, George Furback, they've got a bit of depth, but I did leave feeling, geez, if they don't win a Premiership this year, like, you don't replace Courtney Laws overnight. Absolutely. Lewis Ludlam is your captain, but on the field, you don't replace those guys very easily.
It's a sign of the times, isn't it, that the best team in England is getting picked apart by foreign clubs. Like, that wouldn't have happened a couple of years ago.
It doesn't happen to any other nation bar. Wales and Scotland are different because that's kind of how their model works. Ireland, South Africa.
Yeah, Scarlet's best team got picked apart like vultures. But it's just.
Thanks to Tyke Byrne, by the way. He was fantastic at the weekend.
Yeah. It's just interesting to see that dynamic switch. But yeah, you'd have to say, I mean, they scored that incredible try that I think will probably get European try of the season, that one from deep. And it is a good point. It's an interesting rugby point of...
That's Munster's weakness, is first phase attack. Their first phase defence this year, like, conceded a try to extra off it. This try, they conceded a second phase attacking try, the Freeman one, I'm going to say. Their Northampton second try was second phase off a scrum. And we conceded tries to, I think, the Stormers. I think we conceded one to Leinster. You conceded an awful lot of tries off first or second phase attacking set plays. I think what Northampton noticed is Munster will sit back and they'll let you get a couple of yards. And that's what they did. But unfortunately, they had unbelievable strike runners coming onto the ball and they were gone. And, like, give credit to Sean O'Brien. Sean O'Brien is a centre playing on the wing, and he bursted his hole to try and get back, but he couldn't. Same with Alex Nankivell, same with Mike Haley. It was an unbelievable try, but, like, talk about targeting a team's weakness. That is Munster's weakness. They scored two tries straight off set piece. One off second phase. Makes a huge difference. Change. That's what won them the game, ultimately.
Yeah. It was amazing in that second half that it took so long for points to be scored and neither team gave away a penalty in a kickable position.
It was exactly what Northampton needed, though. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to be cutting across here, but Northampton went for a 6-2 bench. Munster went 5-3. Munster had no second rows. Northampton had already started with three second rows. I think Northampton just knew they had to just stay there. And the longer the game went on, the harder it's going to be for Munster to attack. Because, and I wrote about this in my own piece during the week, Munster were went out, Dave Kilcoyne, who many people will know, like big, powerful, loosehead prop, Jamie Barron, more in the kind of flanker mold, solid player, Ollie Hager, huge for our breakdown, he's unbelievable, John Ryan, Roman Salanoa, also a tight head, Sean Klein, probably the best breakdown operator, second row in Ireland, who happened to have won a World Cup medal, because we wouldn't play him. Tyburn exists, but Tyburn is in a different role. He clears out, but he's a jackal threat and he's a tackle threat. And he's a lot of different things. And Edwin Odogbo, who's another power lock, and Orkay Snaiman, who cried off with a virus. Actually, cried off is a terrible term. I don't want to say that. I'd scratch that. He was sick. Cried off is horrible. Sorry about that. But that's where Northampton, I think they knew, just stay in the fight. If we get to 60 minutes and we're even within a score, I think we're fine. I think they knew that. And like, I think when you've seen them happy to kick the ball back to Munster in that second half, happy to keep, not to play. Typically, they don't play from deep. I know they scored a first phase try and they might start stupid, but typically they don't. They play most of their rugby in the opposition half. They trust their defence to a degree. And the longer that game went on, the more they were going to be able to swallow up Munster. And Munster had chances. Like, there was a chance there after the third try where I think it's not Frisch. I think it's Kendallin makes a half break down the left-hand side. If Conor Murray goes left, it's a 2v1. It's Tom Ahern and Antoine Frisch against...
He had a great game, by the way.
Who?
I think I'm about to get on board the Tom Ahern hype train.
Oh, Tom Ahern's a proper player. And I think he may have been sick. I think he's one of those because he was dead after that game.
But he had that break down the wing. And everyone was going, oh my God, what is that?
We're used to it. He scored tries doing that for us. Yeah. That was his breakout moment in under-20s, actually. First game of the championship, he scores a try from 50, 40 metres, just straight down the searchline. No one could catch him. It was unbelievable. He used to play fullback, by the way. But anyways, 2v1 on the left-hand side, Murray goes right. It's not actually the end of the world, because by the time it gets to Crowley at the back of the screen, he has an opportunity to release Jack O'Donoghue and John Hodnett as their two edge forwards in a 2v1 against Alex Mitchell. Pass doesn't go to hand. And that's actually the turnover that leads to Hendy's second try. And that's, that is corporate at its finest. That's what I tip my hand to Northampton for. Clinical. It's what I noticed in Thomond Park when I seen them. They are fucking clinical. And I don't think many English teams are. I think a lot of English teams are actually wasteful with possession because it is so many opportunities. Munster are incredibly wasteful. But a good cup team. And you know what I'm going to say? And there'll be a few people who listen to this who will hate me for saying this. Northampton are beautifully cynical. They are cynical at the right times. They will concede that penalty knowing you'll go to the corner and they'll back their line out. Or they'll concede that penalty when you've made a 10-yard break. And the best teams do it. La Rochelle do it. Leinster do it. If you're a top team and you think that your breakdown work is not cynical, you were wrong. Because it's the only way you can compete at top level.
Richie McCaw has entered the chat.
Richie McCaw. Andrew Porter. Like, Andrew Porter is one of the most penalised players in rugby. The amount of time he flops over the ball because he sees that penalty and he knows. And it's tactical. McCaw is the prime example. Tyburn has done it loads of times. Tyburn did it against... oh God, I can't remember who. Someone fairly recently where he just flops over the ball. He does not get up off it. He's like, right, that's fine. I don't really care because they'll just, it'll just buy me some time. Like, the best back row forwards, the best teams do it. And I hated that. I loved it about Northampton. I only loved it the second time watching it back when the emotion was gone. But yeah, we might just touch on Munster and Leinster and Leicester and all that in a few minutes. But Northampton, good attack. I do still worry though. Like, my only concern for them is this their only opportunity to win it for a couple of years? It might be, but very different team from last year. You have to give them credit for that.
Interesting matchup against the Bulls. I think we'll learn a fair bit about both teams in that game, I think.
I think so. The Bulls, by all accounts, are dying to prove a point because obviously they got to the 40-minute mark. They were leading against Leinster at half time. They're playing really, really well. They're playing great rugby. Showed none of it in the second half. Like, they just did not show up. Johansson and Papier.
Completely brain explosion.
Yeah, and like...
Jake White would have been going mental.
Oh, God, I would not want him in front of Jake White that evening. Like, not a chance. But, like, you've seen... When you see guys like Goosen just out of the game entirely, Willie Lemieux started to make mistakes. It was game over at that stage. And, like, I don't give the Bulls much of a chance because, obviously, they don't arrive in... Some of them arrive in on, like, Monday. Some of them won't arrive in till tomorrow. It's going to be very hard for them to pull off a result. They might, but I don't see it. I think Northampton are getting back to a semi-final for the first time in like 12 years or something like that, which is really, really good as well. Like, gotta give them credit. And this isn't overstating them as a Munster fan either. Like, it's just really, really impressive to see what they've done.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's just change the gears a little bit and just briefly touch on the Challenge Cup. So 6 URC teams in the 8 quarterfinal spots. Feels like any of them could win it. You've got Sharks in there who have openly said we're trying to win it. Benetton feels like a great opportunity for them to lift their second piece of silverware. Ospreys, obviously the only form Welsh team. Ulster still in it as well, overcoming Montpellier. Connacht are always going to go for the Challenge Cup because it's their best opportunity for silverware. Do you have a team where you think they're the Challenge Cup favourites? Of course, the other contenders will be Gloucester and Claremont.
I don't know what the story is. I'd probably make Sharks favourite if they had a home semi-final, but I haven't got clarity on whether that's something they're going to be able to get. If they have a home semi-final, I'd make them favourites, to be honest. Otherwise, I'd probably look at Ulster. Apologies here now. I'm actually literally a couple of minutes ago, a media statement has just come out by South African Rugby about the Bulls travel arrangements that we just mentioned a minute ago.
Oh, yeah.
So they're essentially saying that they have spent, and I'm trying to find the figure here, they have spent four million rand or four, it says, or 4108. I don't know. It's on two different lines. It's hard to read. But they're saying that they have essentially sourced this. They have paid for it. They, you know, it's the only way they can make it work, that all these different flights going through cities, like, you know, the balance of 8 of the tour squad, 4 management of 4 players travel via Zurich, Doha and Dubai. Like, all, they have the entire breakdown of business class, economy class, everything. Someone did mention it, but maybe going 1 week after the other for this isn't ideal when we've got South African teams. I know it's great for La Rochelle, but like La Rochelle, their playing budget, like their entire budget for their entire club from underage up is 30 million. You know, like that's, they can do it, but it's a solid question mark. I don't know what your thoughts are on it, but like South African travel on 1 week, it's not ideal.
Yeah, it's always going to be a bit of a nightmare. Maybe that was the idea. Maybe someone's gone, we don't much like these South Africans in our competition. What can we do about that?
that could be something. But yeah, no, and even that could tie into the Sharks going back into the Challenge Cup. If someone has to go down there in a week's notice, I would not. Granted, I'm not a professional rugby player, but would you really want to hop on a long-haul flight to go down, to get your ass kicked by Eben Etzebeth, to come back up, to then have to refocus on the league again? I don't think I do.
Yeah.
So if they get a home semi-final, I'd certainly back them. If not, I'd probably go towards Ulster. I think Ulster can have a great matchup for the Sharks. And if they get to a final, they've got a great run of their next couple of games where they have yourselves, Scarlets, they've got Cardiff, they've got Benetton. Benetton at home, which is entirely different. Like, that's a 10-point swing having them at home, if not 15. That's before they play Munster and Leinster. By the time they get to a Challenge Cup final, if they got there, they could be really clicking. So I'd probably make them favourites. And shout out to them. I know Montpellier kind of shot themselves in the foot, or as one of the commentators said, they ran out of feet to shoot themselves into with the amount of cards. But like Ulster and Connacht, the only away wins in the Challenge Cup this weekend, which is really, really impressive as well. And do I see Connacht getting the job done against Benetton? History says no. They've lost their last like two, or they've lost 3 of their last 4 games in Benetton. So I probably wouldn't tip them. I thought, you know, Benetton beat them a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if you touched on it on the podcast. And like, Benetton were the better team. Like, they were easily the better team over 80 minutes and couldn't make anything stick. So, yeah, I'd probably tip Ulster.
That's a team with a hell of a back line, by the way. Benetton, hell of a back line.
Yeah, and their depth. Like, they've got two to a man. Like, coming in next year, it's going to be really, really interchangeable and really, really scary. But, yeah, I'd probably just go Sharks or Ulster. It's going to come from that side of the draw, I feel like. No disrespect to, like, Gloucester or Ospreys, who could, but I just don't see it.
I'm backing Benetton because it's fun, and also I think they get more home games, so I think that helps them as well.
Yeah, they've also won a final recently, which I know Gloucester did, but not many teams could say that.
Yeah, true. Anyway, that brings us to the end of the European chat for this week. We haven't touched every single game, but we can't be here for 2 hours. Like, so just going
to
do a bit of...
Try, but do you really want to talk about Leinster for another half hour? I don't think I do.
Really? Let's do a bit of women's rugby. So there was some international women's rugby games this week. Spain beat the Netherlands in Rugby Europe Women's Championship 22-15. Spain are now on track to claim the title, we believe. Also, Andorra. This is a bit of a shout out, David Lawrence from Scrum of the Earth. Let me know about this one. Apparently, Andorra played their first ever women's international rugby match this weekend, and they beat Bulgaria 119-0. Maybe it was 19-0 and that's just a typo, but David, if that's wrong, I'm blaming you, but if it's right, I'm claiming all the credit myself. Super W, Waratahs have the perfect 20 points from four games. Drew are now into second after they beat the Brumbies. And then Super Rugby Aupiki, the final is sewn up to being between the Blues and the Chiefs after both won this weekend. So rugby around the world then. So Super Rugby, the Blues are currently top, a big win over the Force, and the Chiefs home Baltimore Pacifica 68-12. Tough game to watch for us Moana fans. The Brumbies beat the Tars. The big talking point from Super Rugby this week was the red cards. Did you see these?
I seen Lamani, the scrum half?
Yeah.
I seen that one. I'm sure they'll probably just give him like a 2-week slap on the wrist ban because it's Super Rugby, but that was ridiculous. So I seen that, and I seen there was a second one. What was the second one for?
It was a headbutt after a scrum. The prop just not just happy weird. With his opponent and just stuck the head in the chest.
Yeah, that was weird on every level.
Yeah, so I just want to say quickly that we put out a video about that on the channel on Saturday. And it's got a bit of a reaction, and some of the comments have been a little bit unsavory. So I just want to.
Were they saying the game has gone soft?
There were some players saying "man up and carry on playing," which is unbelievable. And then there were some people assigning Lamani's actions to his heritage. And I just want to throw out there that we are absolutely not about that. If we see any comments like that under the channel, they will be deleted. We don't stand for that kind of chat here on the Pirate Rugby. So moving swiftly on from that, Japanese League One, there was a big game between Sun Goliath and Kobe Steel. We saw a win for Sun Goliath. I watched a bit of that one. And Wild Knights are still 12-12 at the top of the standing. Super Rugby Americas, two Argentinian teams as top as you would currently expect. Selkirk beat American Raptors, which is always fun. There wasn't much in terms of Northern Hemisphere rugby, apart from Coventry smashed Cambridge. Whereas Ealing only snuck past Cornish Pirates, so the gap at the top of the table is now down to just 9 points. So Cov.
Just two games.
Come on, Cov. You've got this. Ealing, you've got them rattled. And then into the MLR, Sea Wolves beat the Jackals 34-32 in another exciting game. Old Glory drew with LA 22s each. Free Jacks beat Miami. But there wasn't a full round of fixtures, so now there's some games in hand going on, so the table is a bit not quite right. And then Welsh Prem, it was a truncated Welsh Prem round as well because they had the cup final at the weekend. But big result was Cardiff hammered Quinns 77-7. That's a big result. Do you keep much up to date with the AIL? I haven't got it noted down.
This week was actually the last week of the regular season of the AIL. It goes into playoffs in 2 weeks' time. So Ternior, Kirkon and Clontarf and someone else, I think it's Lansdowne, the top four in the AIL. There's been some, obviously, some movers and shakers. What's remarkable is for the second year in a row, the team has come up from junior rugby, has been promoted out of Division 2C, the fifth division of the AIL, and have walked it. Have like topped the league and walked it. So last year, Instonians won. So 2 years ago, Instonians won junior round robin series to go up. They then won. This is incredible. 17 out of 17 games. Sorry, 18 out of 18 games. It's 18 game with 18 try bonus points. Now, 18 try bonus points in 18 wins is that's incredible. Amazing. And they've now won. They've gone up from 2B as well. But Clogher Valley, who also went up last year, have just topped Division 2C as well. So it's probably a sign of a trend of certain clubs are getting a bit of a cash injection to push them back up there, which is all well and good at times, but it does mean, you know, with rural clubs and with smaller city clubs will probably take a hit. But it's impressive. It's impressive what has happened, that junior clubs who for years would just bounce back down in a kind of, you know, Premier League championship type of manner have just taken it by storm, which is really cool. If I was a betting man, I'd probably say Terneur will win it, will win the final. The final's in 3 weeks. And the final is a joint event between the men's and women's final, which UL Bows should win. But the only reason they should win that is because they don't have any players in the Ireland squad. But that's for another day's conversation. I know the guys on the Scottish Rugby podcast quizzed me on that there when I was on last time, but that's another debate that we don't need to get into. But yeah, AIL is fun. And if you're Irish and listening to this, go to AIL again. It's a lot of fun. I was at a junior game recently and I forgot. Junior rugby is pretty entertaining, to be honest. You'd forget sometimes.
Great stuff. Awesome. The man in the know, as always. So that brings us to the end of the show, guys. The TV guides will be out on Ender's Twitter as normal. Also, if you subscribe to the Substack, you'll get it sent direct to your inbox. And trust me, on European weekends, especially with the Challenge Cup, you need it. It's essential. You can also tune into our TikTok, the Pirate Rugby on TikTok. We post it on there as well, to some music, because it's TikTok. And so, like I said, absolutely vital piece of your rugby weekend is Ender's Rugby TV guide. Anyway, thank you to you, mate, for joining me and helping me out.
Thanks for having me here.
And I will catch everybody else on the Friday Breakfast Show. Cheers.
Sports Social Podcast Network.